Yes, it's the Neighbourhood Show. We're back. It's myself, Benny, and Chucky Online. And yes, today, sir, we are here with the legend that is Alex Hoffman.
Yay! Yeah, man.
Yeah. Global exec producer and head of music at Vice.
Real G.
He launched the online platform Noisy in 2011, mm-hmm. prior to which he spent 9 years at MTV, pioneering one of the most groundbreaking music shows of the last decade in Gonzo with Zane Lowe. And he's also a director in his own right. And to be fair, he looks far too young to have achieved all this. So I want to know, is it a body shop thing? Is it a Kiehl's face cream?
Talk to us. You say that to all the guys.
Talk to us. And he was nervous about this intro, you know, but that's a solid intro.
Whatever I thought would happen, I definitely didn't think you'd be saying I look young, but...
Nah, you look young, man.
I don't get that a lot. Since the hair started to turn, you know, before the hair, everyone used to think I was young, but now it's all over.
You're good. You can work it. Well, thank you for joining us today, man. It's like a real pleasure to have you down here, man. And like, you know, we're going to get into your story and the background and in the depths of it. You're going to break down some things that we don't understand and... all the rest of it.
Talking about myself for an hour or so, I mean, that's the dream.
You haven't done much of that, have you?
You can't go wrong. You're normally on the other side of it.
Although I can't lie, I didn't know there was cameras in the room.
Well,
I didn't know when you asked, I didn't know there was cameras in the room.
But I thought that's why you did the top button up, to be fair.
Top button's always up.
Okay, alright.
We'll clear it with management, you know, you can have the okay before it all goes out. But don't worry, Alex, is he looking good, Taz? Yeah, you're looking good. Before we get into it, like Vice Group as a whole is essentially like a youth-orientated content producer, would you say?
Yeah, that's fair. It's just it's a media platform. It's I don't know what it is. It's just this huge, confusing, mad thing, but it's been amazing to work there. I went there for like a couple of months to see how it was, and then I've ended up being there for quite a while. So, yeah, it's a good place to work, good people.
Amazing. So... before we get into all of the things you're up to at the moment, I think it's important that we take it back to the beginning and talk about where you grew up and what kind of shaped your childhood and your educational days, you know?
Oh, wow. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
So I've forgotten most of that. I grew up in Northwest London. I think not too far from you, right? I think we might have
Willesden.
Talked about this once. Willesden. I grew up in Kingsbury.
Kingsbury. Okay. That's where I reside
right
currently.
Now. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay. Nice. So Kingsbury. It's not glamorous.
It's
but,
famous,
you know,
for whenever you tell anyone that you live in Kingsbury, they always say, "Oh, that's near the Regency, which is like a famous Indian, which is in a pub."
Oh, okay.
Basically.
Right. But whenever I say it, people go, "What's
yeah,
that?"
Yeah, they say
and
where
you go. It's near Wembley.
Yeah.
And they're like, "Oh,
yeah.
That's
cool
it,
area."
That's it.
I don't know about cool, but Aswad from there. George Michael grew up there, was born there.
Mutia Buena.
Yes, Mutia.
Is he from Queensbury? Yeah?
Went to the same school as Mutia.
When I was
Kingsbury Green.
Kingsbury Green.
Nice.
That's probably all the celebs from Kingsbury.
Yeah. And now?
Stuart Pearce, I think, was from there, somewhere around there.
Yeah. All right. There you go. So foundations in Northwest London, Kingsbury.
Yeah.
Educated.
I was there till I was about 13. Then we moved to Barnet. So still north, a bit further out.
Not too far.
Yeah.
Not too far.
That's me.
And sort of, you know, your school days, were you sort of like, you know, because we've had a lot of people that work in the music business, whether that be managers, producers, you know, and I guess you're in the wider section of the entertainment business, you know, so what are you doing in your school years that kind of lead into becoming a producer?
Nothing much that showed any sort of ambition or thoughts of doing anything good in my life.
Yeah.
But obviously, like most people probably have on this, I was just a music geek from pretty early. From pretty young, even like thinking back to when I was really young, I was always super into it. I had like my best mate when I was really young in Kingsbury from school, and we just used to go and buy, that's how old I am, we used to buy like 7 inches.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, Easy Lover, Phil Collins, Philip Bailey, Roachford, Cuddly Toy.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah.
And just play them non-stop. But I remember thinking back and like, I was into a lot of cheesy pop music like everyone, but there are certain like little things that stand out that I was like, okay, that was actually quite a like progressive thing to like when you were that age.
Give me an example.
Like Me, Myself and I, De La Soul. I remember like me and my mate like learning the words and like, you know, trying to do the moves like them or whatever. And I was probably only 8 or something. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, I like Kylie Minogue and Rick Astley or whatever as well. Oh, wait, this is on the radio. Scratch that. But, like, there are little things that it's just like, yeah, I just started to just get into. Because I've always been into, like, a very broad amount of music.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Just generally, the older I get, more sort of like, yeah, alternative. I just like weird sounds. And then, yeah, just through school, I guess I was really lucky that I was a certain age when certain music,
things
like,
were
happened.
Coming out. Yeah, and certain
and
things.
And I was, like, 12 or something, which is the absolute dream age for like grunge to happen.
Yeah, okay.
I know not necessarily probably played on radar that much, but to be 12 years old and Nirvana and all of that, and then Rage Against the Machine happened, if you're like a angsty, you know, young, just coming a teenager, that was amazing.
Yeah.
And then when I was like 15, Britpop happened, so, you know, that was just, I mean, I was into, always into loads of other stuff. I was listening to hip-hop, I was listening to dance music at the same time.
Yeah.
But to be around for Britpop was really like, you know, a cultural moment. You know, I went to all the shows. I just couldn't get enough of it. You know?
And and at that point, were you thinking about your career and your first step into whatever it was you were gonna look to as a profession?
Yeah, but not in a very focused way. You know, I'm sure you guys know, like, you get some people now, people that approach me that from so young are so focused and driven, and they know all this stuff, and they know what all the different types of radio are, they know what A&R is, they know what publishing is. I didn't know any of that stuff.
Yeah.
All I knew is that I had this thing, which was music, that I just really wanted to do. So whenever there was any careers thing or anyone saying, what do you want to do? I was just like, music. But I didn't know what that was. I've never played music or anything. So it wasn't going to be performing music.
Mm-hmm.
So the only things I knew once I got a bit older and I started devouring like the music press and just getting every music magazine you could get.
Mm-hmm.
So all I knew is you could be a music journalist or you could be a record label person. I didn't really know what that was. Obviously, I didn't know what A&R was or what marketing or product manager or any of these things were. Not for a long time later. Mm. But I just knew I wanted to do music stuff. So, yeah, at school, it was just like, we had one thing ever that was like a meeting with someone about your careers. They never talked about it otherwise, but they're like, right, careers meeting.
Mm.
What do you want to do? And I'm like, I like music.
I remember those. Yeah,
and I was like, I want to do music. They're like, what do you play? I was like, I don't.
Yeah,
they were just completely bemused by it. So they just said, get like a good arts degree.
Yeah.
Okay.
And just get as good thing as you can get. And then after that, then work experience or whatever, you know, the usual stuff. So I was like, okay, I'll just do what I think I'm all right at, which is languages. Language is the only thing I could do.
Yeah.
I was not very good at anything else. So I did that. And then I was just like, right, I'm just going to try and get into music stuff.
So you went to study at Manchester University.
Yes. Yeah. Why? You've done your research.
Yeah.
And what did you study?
So I was doing languages.
Which
so
languages? Sorry, that was like a very dumb question because you just said that you went to do languages. But, I mean,
but you do like a variety.
Let me guess what you did. French.
French was my main thing, yeah.
There you go.
Because you know that I lived in France for a bit. Wow.
There you go.
So yeah, my main thing was French, and then you get to specialise once you get into it a bit, and I specialise in film, French film.
Wow.
So I literally just did that. But then whilst I was at uni, I was trying to think at school. Now, at school I was just like a fan of music. Mm. Whereas when I got to uni, I was like, right, I probably need to do something with this.
Mm.
So I started all the classic things a music head does at uni. So the club night, the writing for the student paper, the radio show, you know, very similar to this. You know, it's very professional in Fuse FM in Manchester. I remember the first show, because like there was probably nobody listening, like literally nobody. So there's one bit, and then we like listened to it back afterwards, and there was like 25 minutes where it just wasn't on air. We were still chatting, but
we've all been there.
I've been there.
It's probably happening right now.
Yeah, like I remember doing pirate radio actually, and thinking to myself, "Rah, why isn't the phone ringing?" Like, are we just there, just doing our thing, barring away, whatever, and then literally leaving the radio station, and then realizing, "Rah, that it wasn't on that whole time."
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I used to do pirate and call Chucks like, "Chucks, are you listening? Like, how does it sound?" And he would be like, turn the music up a bit, or the mic's not clear, or
But you got to do those things, right? Yeah, it's all, at the time, it was so exciting. You know, we knew that probably no one was listening.
Yeah.
But it was kind of mind-blowing. Like, it's different now. There's so many amazing things like this. Like, it feels like radio is really part of, like, anyone young getting into music.
Yeah.
Well, in London, obviously, it's not necessarily there's opportunities everywhere. but it's part of it. You've got to get a radio show.
Yeah.
Whereas back then, we never thought about radio because it was like nothing or really famous radio stations. Yeah. You could never get one. And then when our university had one, I think it was like a month, you know, they have like sort of limited license.
Yeah.
And we just like applied for it because we had this little club night and it was amazing, you know. Like,
did you, like while being at uni, did you then start to understand a little bit of what it was that you wanted to do? Or was you still kind of just...
A bit, but I still, like when I left uni, wasn't like so aware. As far as I can remember, it was a bit of a while ago, but I still was just like, music journalism, I thought that was it, but it wasn't necessarily that I was so passionate about it. It was just one of the only things that I thought you could do. I didn't really know what all the other things were. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I never really thought about management. It felt too far away. Like to write something is just like something you can do on your own. Mm. But to be a manager of someone felt like it's, you know, it's different sometimes, especially in London with like kids growing up, and you know, especially in this sort of, you know, radar world or whatever, like often they're like mixing with artists. Mm. You know, sometimes they'll be growing up, I'm sure you two had the same, where you grow up and then suddenly these artists are doing really well. Mm. I never had that. An artist was something so far away. Like the first time I started, you know, met one, it was like, it was mind-blowing, you know, it was like a superhero.
But like, you know, Manchester in the early 2000s, because, you know, that's a city with a reputation outside of London with a great musical history and heritage at certain points. But what was happening up there into like early 2000s? What was going on in Manny?
Well, I mean, it was amazing, as in that's kind of why I went. Like when I decided, okay, I don't want to be in London for uni, there wasn't that many places that did the course I wanted, but I was like, it has to be a big city because I was so obsessed with it then. You know, just the gigs and the clubs. Yeah. I was really into clubbing and that then, and I was really getting into DJing when I was, as soon as I went to the, I think the, when I started uni was when I got decks and when I just started buying vinyl, just, you know, frenetically. Mm. So it had to be somewhere with a good scene, but it wasn't so much like local Manchester stuff so much. There was a bit of sort of like, I don't know what you call it, like alternative hip hop stuff. There's some quite cool like club nights, some local record labels, but they weren't like big. The main reason I went was just because I knew all the shows, like I wasn't going to miss anyone. Mm. Like that first year, I mean, I basically, the first day, I think, of going to uni, as far as I can remember, or the first couple of days, I just went to like the ticket shop, bought a load of tickets, you know, like two tickets, four tickets, and then I was like, right, I'm just going to have to find mates. I had mates that I went up there with, but not really music heads. So I was like, I'm going to have to find people to go with me to these shows. I remember the first day I bought, like Daft Punk played in my first year on their first album, Chemical Brothers, loads of stuff, loads of everything I was into. I just wanted to go with everything.
Crazy.
So you graduated from Manchester University. What happens after that? You come straight back to London. What are you doing?
Yeah. So the lucky thing I guess I had, which a lot of, you know, kids don't have after uni, is that my family was in London. Or, you know, Barnet. So at least I could stay there. You know, a lot of my mates just came down to London, were like, I just had to get any job. And I was just like, I really don't want to do any job. I want something to do with music. But I had no contacts, really. So I did some work experience. So that was, you know, it makes me feel sort of quite sound, proactive. But I wasn't really. It was only right at the end where I was like, oh, God. Like, it's stressful. I'm sure you guys know. It's like, it's stressful finishing being like, what the hell happens next? You know, like, obviously I wanted to do music, but I always thought it was a bit, maybe it was a bit of a pipe dream. But I had a couple of contacts, like my mum's friend ran a sandwich bar around the corner from a music magazine. And he was like, when I'd see him, he'd be like, oh yeah, you know, I know these people who run this music magazine. So he asked them and they'd let me go for a couple of weeks work experience. Doesn't exist anymore. It's mainly like a dance music mag. Mm-hmm. So I did 2 weeks there, again, amazing. I mean, even when I was at uni doing that, I remember doing the reviewing stuff for the university, like the student paper, obviously CDs back then.
Yeah.
I don't know what happens now. I don't know how, like, because back then it was like you go to the music meeting. I remember the first time they were like, who wants this? And I'd be like, put my hand up, and then throw like a CD single, one track with no case, in a plastic case. And it like blew my mind. And I went after the meeting and be like, what happens? Who do I give it back to afterwards? And they're like, no, you can keep it. And I was like, oh my God. I get to keep it. It was the first time I'd ever had like free, you know, music for free.
Yeah.
It was mad. But yeah, so yeah, just being for 2 weeks in that place was like, yeah. I mean, I'd love to, like, I can't imagine what I was like back then. I mean, I was quite shy. So it's not like I was driving them mad.
Yeah.
But I must have just been so overly enthusiastic. Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah, if anyone asked me to do anything, I must have been like, oh yeah, I'll do it.
But that's good.
Yeah, it's great. I mean,
that always can put you into a good state if you ask questions and you do find the way of like being enthusiastic about what it is that you're doing, because you learn stuff, you meet people, and you never know like who then you might end up coming back into paths with, you know?
Yeah, I definitely didn't have any like mentors in the music world that were telling me what to do. I was just going blind. I was just like, okay, I'm going to go into this place. And, you know, I was just super keen. And then as soon as that finished, I got another one, which was in this sort of kind of organization that doesn't really exist anymore. It's a bit more like indie, but they had different areas. And they actually put me in the radio bit. I don't even know what I was doing. I was just helping out there. Mm. Not really doing that much, but again, just happy to be around music geeks. It was all other like music heads that were working, either working there or doing work experience. It's called Channel Fly. They had the magazine, The Fly.
Yeah, The Fly.
And it was all part of the Barfly group. Mm-hmm. And then they had this radio network, like student radio network. So I was helping out there. And then I managed to get an interview for an internship at MTV, which was mind-blowing, even just
yeah, to have that's got to be like, you know, because at that time as well, MTV was like...
massive.
Just a huge official commercial entity.
And when I told my mates, because they all found it hilarious, because I used to sit at home and just watch it non-stop.
Yeah, so it's almost ironic. So, but how did you, like, taking it back then, yeah? As Ben said, MTV was like a massive, it was a huge thing, yeah? And to a degree, if you're not in the music game, it's still pretty far away. How did you manage to land an interview there? Like, who did you know? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of feels bad because it is always someone you know, isn't it? But my sister, her like best friend was in like marketing something at MTV. And she was just really went out of her way to help me. Do you know what I mean? It does always make me think sometimes when someone sends you a thing, which happens like every 10 minutes, someone's like, can you help someone out, or work experience, and you really want to help, and then you get busy. But like, she didn't have to, and she really went out of her way. But like anything in this world, it's just like so much of it is luck. She happened to go around. She was like, oh, you know, he's really into his music. So there's a lot of areas in MTV, like in any music company, that's not necessarily so music focused or so like exciting for what I was into at the time.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm gonna go to the like talent department. And then she worked in the like international office in Oxford Street, rather than in Camden was the like UK office. So she's like, I'm gonna go around to the international European basically talent people and see what's going on. And she just happened to ask, and literally the guy straight away was like, oh yeah, actually we're interviewing for this 2-month internship for the MTV Awards, for the EMAs, right? See. For the Europe Music Awards. And we need someone really soon. And I've interviewed like 5 people and they're all hopeless. Can he come in tomorrow? So obviously I was just like mind blown. Wow. Like if I think now to when I got that email or call, I guess, I was literally just like shaking. And it was, and then I got that. And then I think it was maybe hours later, the radio place, which was very small, but still the thought of getting any job that was paid in music was mind blowing for me. So they were like, oh, our newsreader is leaving. Do you want to read the news?
Right. Really?
Wait,
on this student broadcast network or whatever it was called.
Okay.
Which is a small thing, but obviously at the time it was just like, what? And it wasn't just like a music thing. You'd read the news, right?
Yeah.
You're a newsreader.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. And so then I was like, oh, I've got this interview. Maybe I won't do it because I'm getting offered a job here. Then I was like, I spoke to my assistant. She's like, what are you talking about? You have to go for this. It's MTV. This is not this small place you're working at. Anyway, obviously went for the interview, and just such luck that they needed someone quickly. I dread to think what I was like in this interview, and I'm sure I was pleasant enough, but like when they explained what I was doing, I was just like, I don't know what any of this is, but it sounds amazing.
It sounds good.
Yeah, they like basically said it's a 2-month internship running up to the EMAs, obviously, which I'd watched every year, and the MTV Awards, the American one, I'd watched every year. And they were like, it's in Frankfurt. So you're going to work for like 7 weeks here, collating all the information, speaking to all the labels, getting all the stuff to do with the people who are performing and presenting and attending, all the nominees. Menial stuff, but it didn't matter, obviously. Mm. You were just in MTV. And then you go out there and you spend a week working there and you help with getting the talent around the venue.
Wow,
I'm
crazy.
Like, what? Wow. That's like, it was mind-blowing just to be there. And then literally left thinking like I didn't know what questions to ask. I didn't understand what that was. I didn't know that that was a thing that people help talent get around. You know, you don't think about what's behind the stage and all the bits that go into making a huge show like that happen. And then, yeah, literally like hours later, they were like, yeah, cool, do you want to start on Monday?
Sick. Before you did the interview, what did you do to prepare? I mean, you had less than 24 hours, but like, what did you do anything? Did you make any notes? Did you write anything down?
You know what? I really can't remember. I must have done. But I think Debbie, my sister's friend who got to me, I think she just put my mind at rest. We're just like, oh, it's not really an interview. You should just meet this guy. Mm-hmm. I don't even know. I really can't remember. But I don't think in my head it was as big a deal as it actually was. Like, it was so life-changing.
Yeah.
You know, actually completely life-changing. Who knows? If I hadn't got that, I might still be reading the news on the, obviously that thing went under like weeks later. Well, a few years later.
So look, it's a two month internship. Is it paid or is it unpaid?
It's paid.
Paid.
So back then, well, still now, I think all the MTV internships are paid. It's 150 quid a week, which at the time was like.
But listen, the record labels were operating slave labor until very recently. Let me tell you.
Yeah, there's a lot of companies still. You know.
Can I just ask a random question? Is there any like internships in music today that pay?
Yeah. All the record labels now have to pay. You can do maybe work experience for like for free for a couple of weeks maybe. But if you do at Universal, the year long internship pays I think $1,000 a month or something like that. But I think they give it's like one person. Like through the whole, you know.
Just to fit the role. Okay.
So so you fell on your feet nicely.
Yeah.
But it was 2 months and you know, at the end of the 2 months, what you know, that's fast approaching. Are you thinking you got to look for other jobs? But now you can put MTV on your CV. Like,
I know it's crazy thinking back because I thought like, oh well, now once I've got that, that's like amazing experience. But obviously, it's 2 months. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Think about now, given that, I've, you know, you when you're looking for jobs, you look people looking for 2, 3, 5, 10 years experience.
Yeah.
So to have 2 months and something, but it's still a good start. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I was. I mean, obviously I was nervous towards the end of it, but I was too excited to be doing it to worry too much.
Yeah.
But I was definitely trying to get around the company and talk to people and just be like, oh, I'll do anything.
Yeah.
You know, I remember like when I was at the awards, one of the people that I got chatting to like worked in the tape library or whatever, and he was like, oh, we do like shifts in there. You could work there. You know, like I'll email my boss, and I was like, "Oh my god, amazing!" Mm. Obviously, a few months later, I'd be like, "Well, that wouldn't be a good move." Mm. But at the time, I was like, "I didn't care. I just wanted to be there." When you're in the building, it's like, "Oh my god, look at what these people are doing. Their lives is revolving around music." Mm. So I just wanted to stay there, and luckily, because I only did a 2 month internship, as I finished it, there was a girl I got to know who was in the like press department. Who was like, well, our internship's coming up. You should speak to HR, see if you can do another one. I know you can't do 2 6-month ones, but because yours is only a little one, maybe they'll let you do it. So I asked, and that got sorted out. So I worked for 6 months in the press department. Again, not really doing stuff I was so passionate about.
Yeah.
What was you doing though?
I mean, God knows. It was like, it was the sort of international team. So it was quite corporate. Like, it was basically in the international president's office. So you were kind of like collating all press stuff about MTV, but more as a business, but nothing really. But I was still so excited to just be in the building and be able to, you know, say I work at MTV. I'm here. Mm-hmm. I'm getting to meet people because I was quite shy, so I wasn't the type to be really networking and going around the building networking. So I was just in there, and I stayed there. Then I managed to get that extended a bit long enough that the Europe Music Awards started coming around again, and then. Because I sat near the old apartment, they were like, oh, we've got to have you back.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I pretty much just did what I did again, but they hired me like as a freelancer. Still not exactly getting paid much, but I was going to the awards again, and it was in Barcelona.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you stay in the hotel. You have to be with the talent, right? Yeah, so you're staying in the hotel with the talent. I mean, even the first year, it's just like...
Who did you meet first year?
I mean, I say meet is definitely in the loosest possible sense.
Who did you...
you're in certain situations.
Rubbing shoulders with.
I think, to be honest, I think that's what got me the job. Now I remember it, is that even though I get excited as I you know, I love, you know, artists and stuff, and, you know, we all get gassed sometimes meeting artists, but I wouldn't have done it in a... showy way. I wouldn't go up to someone. I'm not going to start. Oh my God, asking for a photo. And you got composed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've never done that.
Yeah.
So when I think that was, I think I remember him saying afterwards that that's what swung it. Is that he said, like, you know, you're going to be around, like, not just artists, but like A list.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the first year, I'm trying to remember who was there. Definitely, I think Jay-Z played the first year. I can't remember which year's which, because I ended up actually working on it for a few years after that.
Yeah.
But you're talking Kylie,
yeah,
Beyonce,
some really big superstar.
Whitney.
Wow.
God knows, Timberlake.
Yeah. But you touched on a good thing which you spoke about on the show before, in that, you know, you just got your foot in the door. It wasn't necessarily an area that you knew that you wanted to work in, but it allowed you to kind of navigate the building and get an understanding of the dynamic of a company like MTV. And whether it was working in press, whether it was working on the live event side of it, like you know, whether it was bypassing the tape library or whatever, you got to see the structure of the company. And I think it's like an important lesson to kind of re-highlight for young people trying to get into the business. You knew you wanted to work in music, you knew that you loved music, but what it is that you were going to ultimately end up doing was something that you had to discover, you know. And I think that that's a lesson for a lot of young people to just take away, that you just got to get in and just see what's going on, meet people, start to get an understanding for yourself of the different roles and jobs, because you can read it on the paper, but you never really know it until you're in there, you know.
Yeah, I agree. So it really is a fine balance, and I would definitely say that to young people. I find a lot of young people quite impulsive with that. They'll do something for like 2 weeks and be like, oh, I hate PR. I'm not doing that. Or they just want to move. They always want to like move companies. And, you know, sometimes that's great. But, you know, it's not always great. Sometimes the longer you stay somewhere, the more you might be valued, or you might be able to move around within the company a bit more easy than just keep moving. So, you know, it's different for different people.
So you've done the award shows a couple of times. You've been, so you've technically been in the building for a year.
Yes.
Yeah, over a year. Seen some amazing things. Met some people.
Yeah.
Networked, being around the building.
Yeah, I would never think that I networked, but I wasn't doing it meaningfully. I was meeting different people in different
It didn't feel like it was networking.
No.
But,
and then I guess what it was basically from doing this job, you do get to meet quite a lot of people because I mean, it's fairly boring, but what I was doing those 2 years is looking after the talent escorts, which is what they do. Loads of people from within the company across all departments apply to be a talent escort. And they get assigned to an artist.
Yeah.
So they basically just got to like get them towels and get them, make sure they're seated. That's the main thing, is you got the, you know, you got the walkies on.
Yeah.
And you just get the director, whatever, of talent just shouting. And you're like, we need them seated now. You know, they're about to get nominated for something. It's like, who's got eyes on so-and-so, you know?
Okay,
and it's like,
okay.
And then it was intense. Your artist. You're like, oh shit. You know, you're sweating it because most of these people, they don't work in talent. They work in some random place. So this is their one night where they need to like represent
and
do the job, so it's quite stressful. So I met a lot of people, met someone who there was a job going, basically, which, again, no disrespect to the people who very kindly offered me that job, but was nothing to do with what I wanted to do. But again, it was in the building. It was less interesting than the previous job. It was a technical thing. It's called like presentation scheduling. No disrespect to presentation schedulers. But it wasn't even for like UK. It was for like, they ran a bunch of, this is boring anyway. I did it for a few months and luckily I got to know the people who worked on MTV2. And I knew that I wanted to work in the music channels, obviously. There was a little area of MTV that had the digital channels, whatever, the music channels as they became known. And there was a little quadrant where there was MTV2 and MTV Bass. MTV2 is like indie, alternative, all that stuff. MTV Bass, obviously hip-hop, R&B. And they were like sort of facing each other, well, backs to each other, but there was a little quadrant where they'd always be like just talking about music. And I was like, oh, I'd kill to be there.
It's
just like every day just coming and watching videos and having funny arguments about stuff. So I got to know them and I was like, I've got to get in there. And it was like anything, really, just total luck that after about 6 months of doing this really dead job, like how often does that happen? Like a junior position that was it was called channel assistant. So it was a bit of production, you know, helping on the shows, scheduling, you know, music programming, just everything, just being the general.
But assistant. You're working as part of, I mean, how big is the team on MTV2? Is it
not very big? Yeah, 3 or 4.
I've always wanted to know, like, how big. Because, I mean, I went into the building 1 or 2 times, but I always wanted to know how big the operations were for each TV station.
Well, the thing is, it's a bit like Vice. You know, you get lots of people across the building who work across all the channels in some way, whether it's marketing or sales or. But in terms of like the production, basically the music programming and the making stuff, because obviously they don't really make content, music content so much anymore. Mm. But back then they were doing, you know, we had Gonzo with Zane and they had The Lick with Trevor, mm-hmm. but they also various events and festivals and interviews, and we had artists in like every day. They had a little like sign, like an LED sign on the door, and it was like, today MTV welcomes, and it was always like at least one artist that would be like Girls Aloud and The Killers or whatever, okay. you know. And then gradually as the years went on, it would be like less and less, and then suddenly it was like there's no artists coming in, really, very rarely.
Can you explain to me what a TV producer is, and what a TV and film producer is? What is that?
What, in the MTV
yes.
two sense of the word?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's what's weird about it is that most people who do that now, who do what I do, do like film school or some sort of TV production, video production. I didn't, so I just got thrown into it. So I was pretty much doing like scheduling, like which is like helping work out what goes on when, you know, what playlist hours go on when. We used to play shows like The Osbournes and Jackass and all of that. And in terms of making the shows, it was pretty much Gonzo. And yeah, I had no experience, so it was basically helping writing the links, right? So it's, which is, I mean, you know what links are, right? It's just a bit that Zane says. So it'd be in between videos. So it'd be getting him the info, what the video is, what he's supposed to say, what he's supposed to throw to, what other shows he's supposed to throw to, interview questions, pulling stuff off the message boards. That was big then. It was all stuff that was, yeah, I didn't really need the so much. Like, oh, mate, that was big.
That's a throwback.
Chucks, we need a producer because we're still writing our own questions out here. This yeah. is where we've been going
hey,
wrong.
Taz, well, that's what's mad. I didn't need to. Us,
yeah, but I didn't need to because Zane knew way more about any of these bands. Like, his yeah. memory and just knowledge was yeah. so ridiculous that it was just like, I don't really know why I'm writing these things.
So look, let's talk about that. Let's get into Gonzo and let's get into, you know, the relationship with Zane. And I mean, how far into your time at MTV was it before, or MTV2, should I say, before you sort of, I'm guessing you met Zane pretty much, he was already at the station
yeah,
when
yeah.
you started working there?
Oh yeah, he'd been at MTV before doing a couple of shows.
But Gonzo didn't exist, right?
It existed when I started.
Oh, it existed
yeah,
already?
Yeah,
okay,
I would
cool.
love to claim credit, but no, it existed. It was just not that long before, it's probably, I don't know, maybe 6 months before, they'd started like MTV2 and they were like, right, well, Zane's obviously the guy from
yeah.
that channel. So they just devised this show. They were like, let's just make something that suits his personality. Just sat on a couch, yeah. weird stuff on the green screen behind, and he'll just piss about basically. And it was every day at that stage.
Yeah.
Used to be every day. Just, yeah, like no one sort of overseeing it apart from us lot.
Mm. Yeah,
it was very sort of renegade in that it became different over the years where you'd get, you know, exec producers and all that, you know, and scumbag exec producers like I am now, but but back in the day you just did anything and we'd just flash up like yeah. images and yeah. chuck videos in there and didn't matter,
you know. But in the first instance, you know, you were a channel assistant,
yeah,
and you know, what was the process of graduating, because ultimately you came to produce that show,
yeah,
right?
Well, I guess that came just through having a decent relationship with Zane,
yeah,
that he relied on the voice off camera. So,
I've yeah. heard your voice.
Yeah, so he would be
in
chatting,
the
and then there'd be someone behind the camera, and he had a really good relationship with this guy Jim, who had done it for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jim eventually sort of, you know, got promoted. He ended up making Dirty Sanchez, and then made
okay.
a movie, yeah. and went on to do other stuff. So he just needed someone that he had a decent relationship with,
yeah.
and yeah, again, it was just luck, really. I was terrified, obviously, the first time I did it. I just mumbled a bit, and then gradually, yeah, we got on well, we got a lot of stuff in common, like a lot of the music, you know, we can get very geeky about, you know, he's like loads of hip-hop stuff, all the stuff that I liked he was really into, but then the same goes for loads of
yeah.
all sorts of music.
So what year did you actually start working on MTV2?
03, I think.
Okay, so then
yeah, I think Gonzo started 02 and I started in 03.
Okay. Crazy.
So there was bands, artists coming through like almost every day,
yeah,
and again they were just hang out. So like it was great because the artists really liked doing it generally, because it didn't really feel like promo.
Yeah.
Zane wasn't really asking them, or if he was asking the music stuff, it was really like he loves the studio, right? A lot of people don't know. He was a musician before he started talking about music.
Yeah.
So he really knows his, so yeah. he nothing he would like more than just talking about studio stuff. Yeah, man.
I think that I have to say this as well while we're talking about Zayn. He's, you mentioned his memory and the way he projects his passion about music is phenomenal. He's never boring to listen to. He has like, he's very inspiring in how he talks about music, how he talks about artists, the stuff that he likes, and the fact that he's got such a broad range of music that he's into.
Definitely.
For you, from your perspective, like, what makes a good presenter?
Well, obviously, I was so fortunate to have been in that situation where, like, I wasn't really producing, directing the show in that way. It's not like I got there and I was, like, trying to help him. You know, it's not like now sometimes where you might work with a new presenter and they're looking at me thinking, oh, well, he's probably quite experienced, might be able to, like, direct them. Whereas then it was complete other way around. You know, I was just this kid and he was just, yeah, such a pro. But, you know, what makes, I guess, just someone who's just, you know, can be themselves. And that's why the show works so well, because he was literally like, well, how can we make a show that is completely based around his personality? Yeah. And they're obviously always the best ones. If you look at all the best music TV shows, I don't know, whatever, The Word or TFI Friday, these are old references, but, you know, they're all stuff where there's like someone at the heart of it and they were just like, this is my passion, this is what how I would want it to be, this is what's going to make me feel comfortable and natural and all the sort of, you know, banter or whatever.
Yeah, crazy.
So 2006, you won best TV show at the NMEs.
Yes.
It's like pretty massive.
I still remind Zayn that he never thanked me when he got
there. Why did he not? I saw a clip where you actually reminded him off camera that he didn't thank you guys, and he was like, yeah.
Was he red faced?
He's such a team. No, he just said, I'm such a team player. Yeah. And he just kept it moving. But that's a pretty massive achievement, and I think, like, just to give it some context, you know, that has been won previously or since by shows like Breaking Bad, The Office, Game of Thrones. Like, that's pretty...
Ours was obviously a bigger budget show than those ones you mentioned.
Yeah, of course. But that's mad. Like, you know, like, I mean, what does that do for you as a producer to kind of win such a big award like that, and up against the shows that you were up against?
No, it felt very nice. It was fun. You know, like, I don't obviously necessarily think about it too much. When I look back, it's more just the great years we had, and that those sort of years, I think 05, 06, that was really like a good, it was a really good time for the kind of music that we were working with.
Yeah.
And we had so many great people come through, and as I say, it was just such a fun show to work on, because everyone just seemed to like coming through, and like quite a lot of the time, you know what artists are like on promo, they're just like kind of zombies, they're just like shepherded towards somewhere, they've done a million things, and quite often they'd get there and be like, well, what are we doing? And then they'd like look up and be like, oh, this is fun, and they'd have like little toy instruments to play with, and they'd be talking about cheese or whatever, and you know, this felt fun. And Zayn, he never had to like fake it. He just loves being around musicians. That's like all he's ever wanted to do, and he's managed to do it for like 20 odd years. It's just like every day he's basically hanging around musicians, and that's how he loves it.
Great conversationalist. As you mentioned before,
he can talk.
He can talk about literally anything. You went on to produce various other stuff for the platform as well, right?
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, once I did that for a bit, then it was just, you know, certain people leave, so you just sort of look after MTV2 as a whole.
Mm.
So Gonzo's still the flagship show, but you do various festivals and specials and one-off events and things like that. So, yeah, it was a good time. We were still doing a lot of real music-y stuff. While Zayn was there, they still were sort of committed to having him as the sort of figurehead of MTV2 and really getting out there. And we did a tour, Gonzo on tour, which was like, I mean, yeah. We look back, and it's not like one of those things where you look back and you realize how good it was. I remember at the time, we'd have moments late night on the tour bus and, you know, maybe a bit worse for wear, and we'd have loads of just great people together from the team. And I'd be like, it won't get better than this. Like, you don't realize, this is not work.
You
don't realize what it's like. Like, we are on a tour bus, and we'd like be on a tour bus going around, and then we'd get to the next place, interview bands, and they'd be looking at our tour bus going like, what the fuck? Like, we've got like some crappy little van and you've got this tour bus that you can actually sleep on. And it was so much fun. It's kind of funny. Like, I remember the first weekend we did it, we left on like the Thursday night, and we got back on like the Sunday night, maybe late, like literally three gigs, and then got in and work on Monday in the morning, and it was like, how are you? And we were like, oh man, life on the road, you know, it's quite tough. I'm like knackered. And then you talk to these bands and they'd be like, we've done like 67 days in the van. We don't have like, we had like a day room in a hotel. So you'd wake up, you'd go to the day room, you'd have a shower, at least feel like a human. These bands, some of them are just slogging it.
That's crazy. But even doing it, I'm sure it's a lot easier doing it like Drake on the private jet and whatever, but still, like, just all of those time zones, all of those shows, every single night, like, it's no joke. No joke. Like, aside from being the artist, just being a member of the tour crew or whatever, I mean,
it's just, you know, as intense.
Yeah, like, that, you know, that's got to be a lot.
Yeah, well, you guys know because you're sort of part of it, but most people who don't, yeah, they have zero sympathy if anyone ever complains about being on tour.
Of course.
Like, that's mental, like... Especially if you're like in a band, or I guess being a solo as well, because you're still in a band, it's still a gang that you're together with.
Yeah.
It's like, imagine being that close, even your best friends, if you're together non-stop and you never get any sleep and you're then going on to the next thing and you never get to stop and eat and going to the next thing. And then there's always a party, which I know you could say, well, you don't have to go to the party, but you're kind of doing
when
it's
everyone's
there
going
and everyone's offering you a drink and everyone wants a piece of you. And then the next day it's the same. Like, you're going to fall out with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to lose your mind at least three times a day. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, what's happening now. People gradually in the industry are starting to realize, like, we actually have to try and look after artists, because it sounds like the dream, and it is, but, you know, there's a price to pay.
That's why you probably had a lot of artists before. I mean, I know an element of it still happens today, but at one period of time, you were getting a lot of artists that were having breakdowns.
Mm.
And that was because of how heavy their schedule was and just the amount of time that they were on the road. In a mix of all of that with the partying and all of the other stuff, intense.
Yeah, and people like have just that obvious reaction of just like, oh, what a dick.
Yeah.
Every time someone's acting weird, oh, dick.
Yeah.
Oh, Britney shaved her head. What an idiot.
Yeah.
Kanye's like having some sort of, you know, chatting loads of crap on stage. What a dick. And I was like, I don't know, man. If that was your friend, would you think that? You might think, oh, hang on, maybe they need a hand. Maybe they need a bit of time off.
And but doing that volume of or producing that amount of shows at that kind of frequency, you know, sometimes things must have gone wrong. Sometimes things must have been difficult. You must have had some hard shows, or maybe from a production point of view, maybe from the point of view of the artist. I mean, you know, what are some of the obstacles that you overcome?
No comment.
That said, no comment.
No. You mean on Gonzo specifically?
Yeah, well,
on Gonzo, I was so lucky. It was so much fun. The amount of people we had come through, like, if I think back to some of the, you know, the ones you remember is the ones where you were like, oh, God, you know, and you could see them walking down the, like, you know, the aisle of the office to come through to our little cupboard that we had. So it was great. But, of course, it's like Zane's the same, right? Zane's the same in that his schedule is always mental, and he always packs it and he always wants to do more. And I saw him not that long ago and he's still doing the same. Mm. He's working. He's not just doing the radio for Beats One, not to mention another radio network.
It's okay, you can mention it.
But he doesn't just do that show the whole time. He kind of runs the whole thing. He's constantly getting the artists, dealing with the Drake show and the every other artist and Q-Tip and Dre and all these other shows. But then he's doing all this stuff. He's doing this Apple TV show. He's doing, you know... And he was the same then. He was doing voiceovers and he was doing DJing and he just was just always just wanted to work, you know, just wanted to do stuff. So knackering for him. So, you know, sometimes he wouldn't be in the best form.
And
sometimes, I mean, rarely, but we did get the odd one where artists wouldn't get it, you know, wouldn't understand what was going on. And other times we'd have stuff like, I can remember one legendary artist that came in, started doing the interview, and then we were like, let's keep it. We'd always try and keep a guitar around or like instruments just in case. And we're like, let's give him a guitar. And he started, and it was one of Zane's heroes.
Mm.
And this guy just started playing and was like, oh, how's that riff go again? And he just started doing the stuff. Zane was like,
that's
so into it. And then, like, the next day, he was like, how's the edit going? And it's like, we lost it, didn't record.
Oh my god.
Wow.
Do you know what? Those things are my biggest.
And I'm not talking about like a UK artist that's like, because that's happened with the UK artists where we're like, I'm so sorry, but we're going to have to do that again. And they come in and the first minute's awkward and they do it. This is an American artist that is never going to come back and didn't, and it never happened.
No way.
That's crazy.
And that's not the worst story from MTV. There's stuff that I wasn't involved in.
Oh
my God, yeah. Stuff where like an evening this was based, I'm not going to say what artist, but like an evening where it was the big studio, Studio A, right, which we didn't ever get to go in. And it was like an evening of having fans in there. So they get to ask questions, they get to watch them perform, and they get to see an interview. So it's like a good, with all the stopping and different passes of the tracks. Yeah. It was probably 3-4 hours. It was like the ultimate thing. Four times a year they'd do like, I can't remember what it was called, but it was like a big meet. And yeah, just did the whole thing. And there was the galleries. It was not like just us, were, you know, in the cupboard. Mm. Big gallery, all staff working on it. And they just finished it. And it's like, yeah, we got it. No audio.
Do you know what? Let me say, let me tell you this here. You see, if I was a fan though, if I was there and I was in a part of the audience and it didn't go out, I think I would, it's not that I'd be happy about it. But do you know what? At least then I know that I was a part of something special that nobody else is going to witness now. That it's not out.
So,
I know it's
so great for the person in the crowd, but for the person
who didn't record it,
whose one job, it's not like with us where you have to do 10 jobs. His job is, or her job, record the audio. You're the audio person.
Fired.
Think, yeah, I don't think they're around for much longer.
So fired. That's fired. But anyway, so how did you go on to progress within MTV, because he was doing the Gonzo stuff, he was performing other, he was part of like filming other bits of content as well on the station. How?
Yeah, it was just kind of natural, really. Like I was just there, right? So eventually, people leave, and then you end up just sort of running it. Then there was a little spell where, again, kind of boring, but we got moved to another office, another production company. Mm. It's basically like a production company. They decided to let people pitch on the content. So basically we got like outsourced to a production company. So still making Gonzo, still making the video, all the MTV stuff, MTV2 stuff, but we're making it in another production company. So I went there for a little bit in Portobello. But Zane came with and did all that. Mm. But it was sort of coincided with the time where MTV was gradually sort of less and less commitment to like good new music, and Zane was like the bastion, right? Well, as long as we had him, as long as I was like next to him, I thought, I know they're still going to do good stuff, because they might not have got him and they might have thought, why is he not acting in a sort of conventional presenter manner? Why is he not doing his piece to camera at the beginning and looking down the eye? Why is he sort of shuffling about and making in jokes with this mumbly guy off camera? It was still happening, but then eventually once Gonzo went, it was like, right, well, this is sort of probably the time to start looking around. Mm. And that's when I was sort of, and I'm not going to lie, I was quite nervous then, because it was a different time. Mm. There wasn't the sort of all these digital platforms at the sort of level that they're at now that are like making a serious amount of good quality video content.
Yeah.
You know, at the time it was like, there's TV and there's, you know, there were some people doing little bits and pieces. It was only Vice really that decided we're going to invest in online video in a big way, and like documentaries, longer stuff. And I remember at the time people were like, who's going to sit at their computer and watch a documentary?
That's what I was going to say. How did you feel about that?
Before we segue though into your next chapter at Vice, just before we segue into that, because you talked about Zane's enthusiasm, and it kind of, I think it kind of transitions in the same way. You know, when he left the UK to go and work at Apple, I read a piece where you spoke about the sort of cynicism that you received at the hands of the British public for how passionate and enthusiastic that he was, and that you felt like, you know, for him to go over to the States, you know, they kind of celebrate those characters over there. You know, you can be a lot more, I guess, outwardly ambitious and, you know,
enthusiastic. Just enthusiastic. And, enthusiasm is considered great over there, whereas in certain worlds, especially in like certain music circles, you know, it's considered a bit much. You know, you don't want to be too over the top. And he knew, like, he always used to make jokes about it. Like when he moved over to England, his first job was in a record shop in Music Video Exchange in Camden.
Yeah,
and it was proper. I mean, you know what people in those sort of record shops are like. It's just like quite very dour, snappy. Quite dour, very quiet, sort of like mumbly sort of thing. Like if you don't know your stuff, they're not really interested. And he went there and was just like bounding with energy, like, hey guys, what music are you into? Well, and they had to like they had to take him to one side and be like, dude, you need to chill out. This is too much. Because like what you see like on TV and what you hear on the radio, like that is him. He's just like full of energy. He loves talking. He's just so enthusiastic about music. Like people always say to me, like he's not really into all that stuff. Do you know what I mean? He's putting it on for the camera. And I was like,
no,
dude, honestly, he's just, he lives for it. He wakes up and is just like, what music can I listen Hero. To now? Yeah.
You, so we were talking just briefly about like, not much people like kind of invested in the online stuff, and there wasn't so much things digitally in that sense. Because I were, while you was talking, one of the things I wanted to ask you was, what was going online? What was happening online at the time? Because for me, I'm not gonna say like I felt like I missed the boat. But I never had the foresight to see that online was going to become,
which is weird given your name. You should have been,
I know, isn't it? It's mad, I know, but yeah. That came kind of later on actually. Still,
he's got you.
Yeah. But yeah, like, did you have that foresight to see absolutely that online was going to be,
not absolutely not. I don't want to claim credit, you know. I do, I was actually just in the Great Escape doing a couple of like panel things, and there was one in conversation bit where they were speaking to a bunch of sort of people who run music outlets, and talking about how you can make it work. And I do sometimes, like in that one, get credit for things that's really not my doing. You know, like Vice definitely had the foresight. You know, I don't know if it was luck or whatever, that it's just like video, online video. Like if they hadn't have made that call like early on, and I remember it because I was always been a big fan of Vice, and I kind of knew a fair amount of people there. When they start, I was just, because I'm actually not that tech savvy. So I'm always like a bit behind on things. I'm not like the first one to get the, you know, Apple Watch or whatever. And then when they were doing all this stuff, I was like, this documentary sounds so good that they're doing, but am I going to watch it on a, I didn't even have a laptop. I didn't even have had a computer. I knew at work, and at work I'm busy. So I don't know, for whatever reason, they decided to really make it a focus, and they've never stopped. Like every platform, everything they do, it's like video first, high quality video. And keep getting higher, you know. And when they do the TV, it's like, right now it has to be, can't just be what we do online and then we stick it on TV.
Yeah.
It's got to be premium, you know, while they get people like Spike Jonze, you know, director involved, but it has to be, you know, top notch.
Can you talk to me a little bit about your relations, your early relationship with Vice, and how you ended up connecting with them? Because, you know, you're doing your stuff with MTV, you are a part of something phenomenal with Zayn. It must have been quite a scary thought to go into something that, you know, you admittedly just said that you didn't particularly see the foresight in.
Well, I think I did by then. By the time I went, you know, Vice was doing, you know, great stuff and was starting to do well. It wasn't anywhere near the level it's at now. When I joined, it was probably like, I don't know, 40 people in the office or something, and now there's like 350. But how did I get connected with Vice? It's funny, if you ask most people of sort of my vintage about Vice, there was one issue of NME, and to be fair to them, they really got on it early. Like, Vice was this very cool thing in New York, and it hadn't launched over here yet. But someone at NME obviously knew, and New York music, like, you know, the Strokes and all that stuff. Yeah. When that started to kick off, I think they approached some people in Vice New York, and they thought, okay, these guys know their stuff. They should write about New York. Like, everyone at that stage in London just wanted to go to New York, and they wanted to read about it, and it sounded like the coolest place ever. So they basically got someone to write about it, and then they ended up doing a whole issue of the NME that was just called I Heart NY, and it was all written by these Vice people, and it was so, like, wild. It felt like NME in the old days when they used to have much sort of wilder writers, and it was, like, really cool. So I think that was the first time I'd heard of Vice, but then very quickly the magazine, you started to see the magazine around. It was just more of a magazine then. And then I used to DJ quite a lot.
Really?
Yeah, so I did a club night, used to DJ quite a lot. And we started DJing at their venue. Old Blue Last is a Vice venue.
Oh, okay.
So they'd always have the magazine there, and I started to get to know people who worked at Vice because of Old Blue Last. And then we used to DJ there. They started doing a night at Proud, a monthly one, and we were sort of residents at that. And I just sort of knew a few people there. And I always really liked their stuff. Like, I knew a couple people worked there, and I thought that was like a really cool place to work. I'm sure people I work with now who listen to this will be taking a piss, but I thought that was like pretty cool. So I knew about it. And we used to DJ at their parties. They used to do normally like once a year some big blowout party with free booze at some big place, and we'd often get asked to DJ. So yeah, I knew about it, but they didn't really do music stuff so much. They did a bit, but it wasn't like, it's not like I thought it was necessarily a real place where I could, where they were hiring people, you know, of my sort of experience to like regularly make music stuff. But somebody hooked me up with a really amazing lady called Vida, who still works there. She's on maternity, but she still works there, who was running the video department, which at the time, again, was a couple of people. So I met her, had a chat, and she basically explained how, like, yeah, we don't do so much stuff, but we do these collaborations with brands. And they come around every once in a while, and, you know, they were starting to ramp up their game a bit. So they were like, you know, we want people with TV experience. You know, we want to start making really good stuff. You know your music. So if, you know, we're talking to a brand now about a project. If that comes off, we'll give you a shout. I was like, please. It was just a time where I was like really starting to get bored at Remedy, as it was called, the production company. I was like making the MTV shows. Then like nothing, got in touch. And then a few weeks later, they're like, oh yeah, that one didn't happen. Like, that's what happens with brand stuff, you know. They come and go.
Yeah.
And so I spent another couple of months there, like really starting to get sort of like, I don't know what I'm doing. It now Zane's gone, it's like,
yeah,
there's not really that much here for a sort of music head. And a lot of my friends who worked in the in MTV generally, not necessarily MTV2, but were TV producers, went on to Big Brother, Strictly Come Dancing, all of those sort of big reality TV or Saturday Night Entertainment, which was cool, but like, it wasn't my thing. I didn't watch those shows. I didn't know much about them, and I didn't want to do it. So I was a bit worried about what I was going to do, really. And then they got back in touch and were like, we've got something, we've got a series. It's for a couple of months, which I would never have imagined leaving MTV before for a couple of months work. But at that stage, A, I wanted to get out, and B, the thing sounded so cool.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, for them it was normal, but they're like, yeah, we're doing this series of Red Bull, and like the first episode is with Lee Scratch Perry and Diplo, and we're basically just working with all these producers, called The Producers, and it's like in Red Bull Studios. And I was like, yes, before they were like, yes, yes, please, where, how can I start?
Yeah.
So yeah, so they gave me the shout, and I went to work there for a couple of months. And yeah, and it was cool. I mean, I didn't, you know, it was slow getting in there. It was like to be working somewhere for so long and then be in this new office and all these like cool young people. And, you know, I'd never done branded content. So it was kind of a bit slow, but I had something at the end of it. It looked like it was going to work out perfectly, because a couple of months later, I was going to go off and do this other thing. Mm-hmm. Actually, with Zane, we were talking about doing something.
Okay.
And then like the last couple of weeks I was there, they called a couple of us into a meeting, and we're like, we're setting up this new project, like a music project. We want like a platform, because Vice only had, there was only Vice. It wasn't like there was other platforms then. Obviously now there's 400 of them, but they were like, yeah, we're gonna do this music thing called Noisy, and we were all like, that sounds cool. Like, the name's not very good, but like, sounds good. And they were like, no, that's a done deal. That's already been sorted. I was like, okay, cool, fair enough. And yeah, so then it was just like, well, you know, you're the music. Luckily, because most people there are so, or at the time, was so like documentary, news, just, I don't know, there wasn't like a music head. If there was like a old school Vice person there who was the real music head, they would have been like, okay, I'll do Noisy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See a new guy. And that would have been it. But luckily, there wasn't an obvious music head. So, so I was like, all right, let's give this a go. So crazy. I like, did it for a few months.
Before you ask your question, Kano, you've probably got a question to ask. It's funny that you mentioned about the name, that it not being a vibe. But because I was having a conversation the other day, and like, they were trying to come up with a name about something. And I said that the majority of names sound shit until it bangs.
100%.
So you can come up with names.
Look at band names. Like, most of them, if you actually think about it, it's terrible.
Yeah.
Or just, I don't know, Arctic Monkeys or whatever. Exactly. Like Oasis.
If that didn't work, if Arctic Monkeys didn't work out, how dead would that sound? But that's why, you know what, sometimes you just don't even need to overthink certain things, man. Just, you know what, if a name comes to you, a little vibe comes to you, just run with it. If it works out, then it just sounds cool. Nobody's thinking about it.
What I really learned, though, was that once I started getting on like Twitter and we started posting Noisy content, because obviously then it was, nobody knew what Noisy was. A lot of people didn't even, in the music industry, didn't know what Vice was. So I had to, first of all, try and explain what Vice was. And then I go, oh, and then we got this new thing called Noisy there. Like, completely lost already.
Too much.
But once I started searching it on Twitter, you start to realize the amount of people who spell noisy like that anyway.
Yeah.
Mm. There's like a million tweets every day. They're like, oh, my noisy neighbors. And I literally felt like replying to all of them and be like, that's not how you spell noisy. I was like, can one of these tweets just be about something we've made rather than your noisy neighbors?
So you've effectively been headhunted from MTV.
Yeah, let's say it like that.
Let's just say it like that. and then they've thought you were so good, they've just set up a whole new department and made you the head of it.
Again, a slight exaggeration.
Just run with it.
Run with it, Alex.
But were you head of music at Noisy from the jump?
No, I mean there wasn't Noisy at the beginning. It was just we were just making these particular videos. It was kind of with a brand. And it was just this project. We didn't know how long it was going to last. It wasn't like anything like it is now. It wasn't a website. It wasn't like daily stuff.
Sure.
It was very specific content that we were making, like in association with a brand. Yeah. And all I got was like, right, we have to make this big deal. And this happening all around the world. So there's people making noisy stuff in Brazil and in Germany and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And you're the UK person, but we want you to oversee Europe. So you need to go to Spain, France and Germany to make sure they're not completely screwing it up. Because a lot of these... We had a small office relatively at the time, but a lot of these by Spain, France were half the size or less than us.
Mm.
And the video team with one or two people. So they were like, oversee that, but make 10 videos of like relatively up and coming artists.
Yeah.
So I was just like, right, okay. And we wanted to mix up the genre. So obviously I had to get straight and did gigs, did Wiley, did Tempity, but then did a bunch of other, you know, Mogwai, a bunch of like, you know, indie stuff, punk things, metal, all the stuff that like Vice has got heritage in. Mm. Vice pretty much started as like a punk zine in Canada.
Mm.
So even if it's stuff that I'm not massively into, you're just trying to hit all the areas that that Vice music has covered. Because even though they haven't done loads of music content, they're known for parties and they're known for like having live music at parties.
So even though like, you know, on the MTV2 platform, like Gonzo as a show was not necessarily traditional as a TV format, if you get what I'm saying, like you approach things differently, it was quite left, but I guess stepping out and doing and creating content for an online platform and audience, like, is, am I right in saying you're so much more free?
And well, everything about Vice is a lot freer than like most places.
It's quite off the wall, a lot of the stuff that you do, you know.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people who work there don't necessarily realise, like if they went to a lot of other places, it's a lot more rigid.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
People would come to me and be like, oh, what's the music policy? And I'm like, nobody's ever written that down.
Policy
we never have someone going like, no, that's not right. Check the document as to what we do. You know, we do obviously what we think people find exciting at that particular time.
But was that liberating for you to come into?
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Especially, like, as I say, I don't want to say anything bad about MTV because they gave me the job and I had amazing time. And the amount of all these times you had with like artists, as I say, there's golden era with Gonzo, where you know, got to do stuff with, you know, loads of my heroes from, you know, the Beastie Boys to Public Enemy to Tarantino, or whatever, like all these things. It was great, but towards the end, it felt like a bit of a struggle to
to do
something like, sort of exciting.
It's interesting because Vice generally as a platform and Noisy, like you're filling a space that clearly there's a crazy demand for, but wasn't really. Like it didn't exist before, you know what I mean? So you've built this and people have come. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think it's still like that. I mean, that's sort of one of the funny things. Sometimes people might mention some other outlet and be like, oh, rivals or whatever, and I always find that so funny. I was like, well, I don't think, like, I watch and read all of those other places, like, I like them, most of them, and like I want them to do well. I've always thought we sort of stand a bit aside from all of that stuff. Of course, there'll be some things where it's like crossover, but the way we do stuff is always a bit different, especially because I've come from the video side. You know, our bread and butter really is like the documentaries, and there's not really other people. I mean, no disrespect to anyone else. Of course, there is like stuff, there are places, but in terms of like the real priority being documentary and unusual stuff, not just like an artist profile thing. I don't think there's anyone really doing what we're doing.
Mm.
Documentary-wise, you've got an absolute smash on both sides, actually. And, you know, I know that you've been, like, a part of some really, like, monumental documentaries, like one being Top Boy as well, which was a big one. JME, where you talked about the 696 form, which I thought was sick because that's something that I have had to deal with throughout my career, dealing with the 696 and giving my date of birth and my address and all
government
these
name.
Things, government names, everything, and even hip-hop
in
Holy Land as well, yeah. Mike Skinner. One that you did with Poet was when you went to Lebanon.
Yeah.
Like you've kind of like filmed documentaries in places which are dealing with extreme conflict, yeah, at certain points. Where did you get the idea to do that from? What sparked the idea to do such things?
The Lebanon in particular, or just generally?
In general.
I don't know. I guess I've always been, like, I'm a massive documentary head, you know, and especially ones that look at, you know, the sort of fringes of society. You know, people, I get so many pictures that's just like, he's an artist, or like, oh, you do documentaries, doing a documentary about this artist, or do a documentary about this scene. And sometimes, in very rare occasions, that fits into what we want to do, but it's not enough. Do you know what I mean? I don't just want to just follow an artist. It's not really, unless they're just like a wild character or there's something particular they're doing. For example, Skepta going to America, that felt like a time that's like, that needs to be documented. But I've always just, yeah, been obsessed with documentaries, and I watch like, yeah, a lot every week. I watch like, especially like feature docs. I'm just like obsessed. And I say, like, even from, you know, I guess the obvious like reference is something like Louis Theroux, where he's just like wants to go to the fringes of society and meet people who are into weird stuff or outlying stuff. And I've just always been fascinated by that. And again, it's just like, what can we do that other places aren't doing? And Vice has always had this thing where it's like, we believe in this stuff. A lot of people might think it's niche or weird, but we believe in it. And we think if you make this stuff and you're proud of your brand and you put love into it, people will come and find it. And obviously that's been proven, that Vice has got a huge, you know, amount of people getting into it. And they've never had to do really sort of mainstream stuff or commercial stuff, thinking, oh, we better do that because more people will watch. We think that if we stick to what we are passionate about, we'll find viewers and readers.
I think also as well, like, you've done really well at being able to make people like me, like, I'm a documentary lover as well, yeah, and being in the, like, my bubble and living in London, it's easy to forget that there are scenes and things that are happening in certain countries. Like, I would never have imagined that there was a hip-hop scene in Lebanon like that, do you know what I mean? But
crazy.
Yeah, I think that, like, it's really good the way that you've been able to kind of go to these places and, you know, meet some of these people that are living a certain type of life, but then also, you know, we have a lot of things in common, which is obviously music.
Yeah, and as I say, I don't want to take all the credit because Vice was on it early, and they did one of their first big documentaries was Heavy Metal in Baghdad, which is one of the first things that sort of put them on the
so
map.
What? Into
Heavy Metal in Baghdad.
Okay.
Which, you know, the American lot made. But yeah, they've been on it from early and just making weird and wonderful docs.
When you know, you said the word unusual earlier when you were describing some of the content that you guys produce. In terms of the inception of all of those ideas, is there a culture at Noisy where anyone can really throw out ideas, or is there a core ideas team, or, you know, could you be an intern and have an idea and it be heard? Or
I hope so. Yeah, I mean, I'm always sort of open to stuff. I don't think it's dictatorship, you know, like,
yeah,
the people there, I mean, it's really amazing the people we get coming through there. Like, it's crazy. Like, it's kind of worrying when you're a bit older like myself that you get people coming in that are so young and they're just, they know so much stuff and they're full of ideas and they're just constantly coming out with new stuff. But yeah, all the docs that you mentioned are different and come about in different ways. There's a little story to all of them, but all of them just sort of feel right. Any of those big ones you mentioned, they all kind of happen quite quickly because someone will mention it and I'm just straight away just like, yes. And sometimes there's things that I'd be like, yes, but they don't happen. You can't make them work necessarily, or the artist isn't about. But all of those ones, it's just like, it was actually kind of simple.
Why do you think Noisy Blackpool was such a hit?
Well, I mean, first to say, I did not expect it to be that sort of hit. You know, that's the quickest viewed thing we've ever done, not just UK, globally.
Massive. That got a million views in like a couple of days. That, didn't it?
I mean, it's, you know, you can always tell when you're doing something. It's like, you know, we thought it was going to be something. We thought we'd made something interesting, to say the least. but I did not see it. Yeah, of course I didn't see it going like it was. I mean, that was one of those where we didn't know. You know, we had a weekly editorial meeting with all the sort of writers, and the editor at the time said, oh, we've got this, we've got a freelancer who's writing something about, you know, grime scene in Blackpool, which, you know, like now, that's not so strange to have a grime scene in a different part of London, different part of the UK. That's not like mind-blowing. Mm. But he was like, yeah, you should check this out. It's kind of mad. They've got their own YouTube channel and they're all sending for each other and it's quite wild. And I was just like, okay, I don't know, something about it just made me like, you know what, like, hold on that piece for a bit. I want to like check that out. So I probably had a moment like a lot of people I know where you went on the YouTube channel, looked at the views and were like, oh, that's quite a lot of views for like some random place. Yeah. Okay, well, what's this kid? He's like about 9 years old. Clicked on it and just like could not believe what I was looking at. And then clicked on the next one. And then the next one, I'm just like, you just get in a hole where like, this is fascinating. And I know we did get some grief, especially like when we dropped the trailer, there'd be some people that'd be like, oh, why are they doing this? Why don't they concentrate on some real music scenes or whatever? But as I say, I love documentaries. I love a story where I'm like, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe what I was looking at. And a guy called Tayo, who is our main sort of like producer director guy at Noisy, who hired about a year ago, I guess, and he had just started, and almost straight away I was just like, look at this YouTube channel, go up there, like, you need to just go up there. I didn't know if it was going to be 5 minutes or whether we'd even get any access, but even maybe it would just be one little thing where we got to interview Little T or whatever. I was like, just go up there and look for people. I was like, just find them. And he was just like, didn't know what was going on. Like, he'd come more from like a TV, like, he really knew, he knows his stuff, but he came from more of a mainstream TV world. So he went up there first time, didn't find anyone, filmed a bit of, you know, B-roll, you know, just like the sky, just like Blackpool scenery, and was just like, and then gradually, you know, it just sort of, and then as that was happening, not only did we get more content and we sort of start to understand the sort of depth of the story that was happening here, but also the thing started popping off and there started to be more, like, you know, sometimes I can't remember exactly which ones, but like an SBTV or a GRM Daily would like drop a little thing on their Facebook, and every once in a while something would start happening, and then people would be like, what's this, find the YouTube channel. And they started going from, like, when I first looked at it, I'd be like, wow, 50,000 views, that's quite a lot. And suddenly I'd be like, whoa, 500,000 views, that's kind of mad. And then the more Tyle went up there with Poet, who never wants to go to Blackpool again. No, he really likes the people involved, but I mean, it was a lot of stress and waiting around, and, you know, it's tough circumstances.
He's a very active
up there.
Person as well.
Yeah, it? And it's tough up there, and they don't understand. Like when we first started to do it, they didn't know what's going on. They're like, there's some people, some stray. They don't know what Noisy is, and they're like, people want to film us. They're like, who are they? What do they want? But yeah,
it
took a while, but I was just like, I really believed in it, and we dropped the trailer. And of course, there's some people, even people that I knew, that might be like, why are you doing that? And I'd be like, do me a favor, wait, watch the full film and tell me that that's not a story that was worth telling, was an unusual story. And some people, I guess, just don't really, it's normally, I guess, people who are artists themselves, but they're so passionate about the music they make that they don't necessarily understand that music media isn't necessarily just promotion of a new artist. We're not necessarily saying that we think this is the best new music in the UK, but we just think this is a fascinating story, and it is part of the industry.
Poet actually did say to me as well, he said when the documentary dropped, he said that was the most active his Twitter has ever been in his whole time of ever being online. Like, he just said it was incredible, the response that documentary got. And for me, you know, it's funny because you were saying that you looked at the views. I saw it was on, and because he talked to me about it before, so I thought, all right, let me just have a quick check on it because I need to go and do something. When I checked, I think it was like maybe 15,000 views. Then I've come back later on in the day to watch it, and I've seen the views, and I'm like, wow. So I kept, even after I watched it, I kept checking it, and that's why I asked you now, like, why do you feel like it was such a hit? But it was. It was a really, really interesting story.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone else necessarily would have made that. And for me, you know, the views was great. And obviously it didn't do my team any harm within the company that we had such a successful documentary. And one that's now gone onto the TV. They put it on the Vicelander TV channel.
Oh, sick.
But was more, you know, I had an even better feeling from just a lot of the comments that were just like, oh, I thought this was just going to be a piss take thing. Or I thought it was just going to be some little stupid thing, viral thing for like a joke. But it was like, no, you know, they're actually... A lot, you know, some people in the office were like, are they going to be all right with it? You know, they're kids. When you're working with people that are, you know, minors, it's like, obviously you need to be protecting them and making sure they're all right. And I'm just like, yes, we do need to do that. But you need to understand, this is the first thing ever within this whole weird world that they've been thrown into, right? They weren't expecting this. They were just some kids pissing about, doing something. They didn't expect millions of views and all these people around the country to know who they are and them to be celebrities in their own town. They weren't expecting this. This is the first thing, and again, not to pick it up, everyone's got their own opinion, some people might not like it, but this is the first thing ever to consider them as humans. Everything else is just like just abuse. I mean, the stuff that gets written about them, like across socials and everything in the YouTube comments, is horrendous. Like for like a 14-year-old girl, you know, and her family to have to see some of the stuff that's written about her.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. So, like, this is actually, you know, I don't know. I hope, like, we had a really amazing night where we screened it the night before it went up and they came down and we watched it with their families in a packed room in Cameo with, like, 300 people.
Yeah.
And then they performed, right? And you got to remember, Little T and Soph have never performed ever. I don't mean, like, never performed in London. Like, shows isn't part of it, right? All they do, all they know what to do is do a freestyle, one take, someone films it, and then they put it online and it gets a million views. That's to them, that's music. That's what it is. Afghan Dan, I think, had done like one or two shows. But they come to London, there's this packed room and loads of goodwill for them. And yeah, it was a really memorable night.
Mad. So you touched on it there, Viceland TV. Things have come kind of full circle and now you're back on the TV again and contributing content for that as well, right?
Personally, you mean? Not so. I mean, now I've got so many other things. I work quite a bit on Vice.com, like digital stuff.
Yeah.
As well as the noisy stuff. But yeah, I did help out on a few bits and pieces, some pilots and that. And when it was first launching, I helped out on the Noisy London show, which is American. Yeah. Noisy is like an American TV series. But I helped a bit on that. Yeah, I've helped out on a few little bits and pieces.
Crazy. And what's kind of next for you guys? What's the mission statement other than getting everybody to vote and hopefully everybody's registered because the date has passed.
Amen but to that.
Shout out, Sally.
Yeah. What's the mission? What's next for you guys, man?
Oh man, I mean, that's what's the best thing about working there is just like you just know there's something big around the corner. You know, there just always is. You know, I went there and then suddenly this noisy thing came up and then there was this new thing and then Vice News was a thing and everyone was like, oh, we want to work on Vice News. That's the big priority.
Yeah.
And there'll be something new and then there's TV. I mean, I think TV is just like starting really. You know, it's different from like when you do an online thing, it's a bit different. Whereas when you do a TV network, global TV network to really hit home. If you think about some channels that you like, I mean, they sometimes took 5, 10, 15 years to really get going and people know that they're there. So yeah, rather than looking at like what the next thing is, just like the whole thing is exciting, and that's what's great about working there is that you can just sort of move around a little bit and there'll always be something around the corner. But of course, Noisy, we just always want to be super ambitious with it, and the fact that we've got this TV show that's just called Noisy, it really sort of helps the brand. And you know, in America it's doing really well.
Yeah, man.
We just want to keep making great stuff. And the thing about working there is, from the beginning, from the start of me working there, we've always had people at the top that's like, it doesn't matter what the budget is or what you've been told, if you have a great idea, we will get it made. Mm. You know, we'll find a way to do it. And you know, to be fair to them, they stick with that.
And if someone wants to become Alex Hoffman, they want to become
a
head of music, they want to become, you know, a producer, whether, you know, it might be a young person that's working in your company right now, it might be somebody that is in college, it might be somebody that's just got a camera and they're just starting to make their own short films, documentaries, music videos, whatever it might be. What advice can you give them?
Well, I do find this stuff a little bit hard because I do feel very lucky that I was around at a certain time. Like, I don't think if someone came now into the industry with what I had back then, which was a lot of passion and a few bits on my CV of doing student-y stuff, but without a real deep knowledge focus on what I wanted to do. Now you're really expecting, like, the people that we have coming to us, it's like crazy what they've done. I mean, you can see just, like, for example, like someone like Calum, who I'm sure you guys have come across, like, for someone of my age, like, oh, it was absolutely mind-blowing to, like, have a chat with him and be like, wow, so you've done a lot of videos, man. And he's like, yeah, yeah. I was like, how many do you think you've done? I was like, I think I've done about 400. I was like, wait, how old are you again? He's like, I'm 19.
That's mad, isn't it?
He's made 400 music videos, and I'm not talking about, like, for your mate in the garden. Some of those are like massive
videos.
And not just big with numbers, like really nice looking videos.
Yeah.
So something like that is crazy. But yeah, I think it's like a different time. And in some ways it's negative because it's so much more difficult and the standard of people is so much better. But on the plus side, there's more ways of showing what you can do rather than having to like beat down the door and say, I can do this, I can do this. Like back in those days, I couldn't show what I could write. Okay, I could try and write an article. Not that I even knew how to do that. But in terms of so many other things, you can't really show what you can do. Whereas now, you have the tools, of course, not just to go and make video content or to try and write stuff or to make your own website, blog, whatever, all of these things. Start managing artists, you know, like there's more ways of doing stuff. So of course you just need to show the passion. You need to get out there, and you know I hate saying networking because I was terrible at it, but there's no other way around it, right? You need to be in places where people are, but try and do it in a humble way and try not to be too in people's faces. But yeah, I think it's trying to find that balance of enthusiasm and humility. And I think, you know, some people can be so desperate for it and so enthusiastic that they can actually get a bit conspiratorial about it and think everyone's against me and you know, I went somewhere, they rejected me, they hate me, and it's like, no, I mean, we get that with artists, like, oh yeah, I've heard you guys hate us. It's like, what? Like, someone once may have sent an email that maybe didn't get responded to, or they might not know the platforms, know what they're about. Sometimes it's just like, well, we don't really do that, we don't do those sort of premieres, or we don't post everything. But it's trying to get that balance. And I know some people, it's just like they're so desperate to do well, and it's not easy, you know. It's much easier coming from 15 years or whatever I've done and look back, whereas when you're that person, you're just exploding with like that mixture of enthusiasm and like boiling over anger with like, why is it all happening now, yesterday, you know. And I see that with the people I manage and the people at the company, not necessarily always in music and all the areas, where it's that fine line between, you know, trying to appreciate where you are and what's about and what you've achieved, and being ambitious but without driving everyone mental.
Crazy. No doubt.
You spoke about luck, and I just think, like, just to summarize it up, I think, you know, even though maybe your sister's friend introduced you to somebody at MTV and you got an opportunity, you know, there's a lot of people that get opportunities, but are you ready to take the opportunity? Are you invested enough, passionate enough, focused enough to really actually take it with both hands, you know? So I agree with you. There is a lot of luck, and I think throughout the series we've heard that word a lot, but everybody that has sat in front of us has sort of had that level of focus and drive to, regardless of their level of experience, take that opportunity and really grasp it with two hands. And I think that says a lot, and that counts for a lot, you know. So,
and sometimes you make your own luck as well, because I feel like, you know, you, in your situation, you're passionate about music, and your enthusiasm and the fact that you were involved in and amongst certain things that may not have been a big deal at the time, then kind of spark the conversation for, oh, you know what, there's a job going for this, or there's something going for that. Had you not have had that in the first instance, then maybe you might be in, I don't know, BK. Kingsbury. Just
don't say that. No disrespect to Kingsbury.
No, of course, for sure, man.
You know,
they got a new Morrisons and everything.
You do make your own luck as well.
You get certain chances, you know, but then, you've got to just try and grab them. And you know, there's certain, you can be at a place of work, and you need to get to a point where the people who are there are trying to find a place for you.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? The difference between having the luck that something will come about, but if people are really trying to see what they can do to keep you there, which, you know, I'm sure we've all been in, so I'm like, you know, have that the whole time, where someone will come along and be like, oh, there's nothing for them. And it's like, no, we need to try. And it might not happen immediately. It might be like 9 months later. It's like, yes, there's a job. Remember that person?
Yeah.
And, you know, I like it. And you call them up and they're like, oh, sorry, I've, you know, gone clear. I'm, you know, busy doing something. I'm like, great.
Yeah.
But like, you know, people will try and find something for you and they'll remember you and they'll come back.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's about it, isn't it? Can we just quickly put Alex Hoffman, please?
Hardly any grime chat.
I like that still. This was good. This was good.
Everyone would be shocked in the office. I managed to do all that. Hardly talk about grime.
Well, you know, we watch the Twitter, we watch the socials. We know already. We know what is it? He's a you said that what was I reading on your Twitter earlier today? Oh, it's gone out of my head. But anyway,
I hope you check it every day. It's probably me banging on about Cass is dead.
Cass is dead.
Yeah,
that's what it was.
Oh, is it?
Cass.
Yeah.
He was talking about Cass. Cass is, he's declared Cass best MC in the country.
Well, I said there's no one better.
Then Cass.
Same thing, though.
Best MC. No, because when he's saying the best is the number one, whereas I'm saying he's joint, you know, as in like,
okay,
I'm not saying
all right, fine.
There's not
fine.
A better one.
There might be some.
There's not a better.
Don't upset
he's
anyone.
Chosen
his words.
I don't want to upset.
There's not a better MC than Cass.
I think so.
He's chosen his words carefully.
But I think that's more just because I'm excited, because there's a lot of great ones we don't need to talk all day about. Like,
videos.
I think Kano and Skepta are really good. That's a given.
Yeah.
Whereas Cass, in my view, should be up there.
Yeah. Actually, while we're here, I'm a really big fan of what's happening in Birmingham at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
I think there are some sick MCs in Birmingham. And in fact, a few of the MCs today, my favourite ones, are from Birmingham. Are you going to, you know, kind of do a little something up there?
Who knows? Have you heard rumours?
I don't know. You know?
I don't know. You know, we've got a new... Oh, yeah, I haven't talked about that yet. But we've got a new doc coming soon, hosted by Skinner.
Okay.
Mike Skinner. Called Don't Call It Road Rap, which is probably not that hard to work out what it's about, but it's about UK rap.
We're calling it road
UK rap. UK rap, road rap.
Yeah, drill.
Yeah, all of that, whatever you want to... All of that. and he is obviously from Birmingham, or lived there for quite a lot of his time. So he is really in there, passionate about it. He knows quite a lot. He knows JK, Despa, and all of that gang.
Daps.
Yes, so who knows? I mean, yeah, I love it. You know, we talk a lot about... Yeah, in fact, you were talking about in one of these other episodes about, you know, the accent and that, people trying to get their head around stuff. But like, I love all of it. It's like all the regional accents. It went from suddenly like, that's a bit weird, to like, actually, I prefer that to...
People's ears are open to it a lot more nowadays.
Do you know what I think? Because I was thinking about this the other day. I was thinking maybe one of the reasons why initially for us, the accent was a tiny bit of a barrier is because our scene here in London was so new anyway and so fresh. A lot of us were just getting our heads around this and just loving this at the moment. And then when you hear like a voice from outside, it wasn't fitting yet. It's almost like it just was people, their mentality just wasn't ready for it. But today, everyone, like, it doesn't matter where you're from, innit? If you're
but
good,
also,
you're good.
Also, the internet, like, I know it sounds mad, like Birmingham's not that far, but like, just, you know, you can make a tune, put it up. I don't know where you're from. Big up Jussie. Jussie's in the house. We were talking about Lotto Boys. And I was like, but where are they from,
Banger.
Though? Because I'm like, there's an accent there. I can hear it.
But it gives, gives it character.
Because I got a banger.
Yeah, it gives it character, man. When I really, I mean, obviously I've been into some of that stuff for a while, but listening to the J-House record, and then like when Mist comes on, it's suddenly like, that sounds like such an iconic voice that you've been hearing. Feels like you've heard that your whole life.
But
when he started rapping, it's like, that sounds like, I don't know, like hearing some legend or whatever. I don't know why. It's just he's got such a distinctive voice. And it didn't sound like, oh, who's this weird Brummy guy? It feels like that's someone
who's
like a really important...
He's got his style locked, though. Yeah. He's got his style locked. Yeah. They got missed every time.
Sorry, before we go again, was you involved in the Rants and Bants advert? Is it an advert?
It's not an advert, no.
Funny enough,
I saw what gives me life is looking at comments, right? But looking at YouTube comments is wild and funny. But looking at Facebook comments, like we're now obviously Facebook videos quite a bit. Facebook comments are next level. Like you can put a video up and within like a minute, there's people writing essays like longer than I've ever written. And nobody seems to understand, they cannot get their head around why something could be a joke. Like, you can just put some like silly thing up on there.
Yeah,
like,
no, they don't.
I disagree with this documentary. Like, because it's not a documentary. Yeah. It's just like a funny thing. Yeah. Like, we do make those as well, but this is just a 2 minute funny thing.
But like, it was funny, and but it was still also like a kind of indirect way of like reaching young people into like trying to explain to them in a funny way why you should kind of register to vote. You know,
I hope so. You know, it seems really. Maybe this has happened before. I don't think it's happened in this way.
Nah.
Where it's just, you know, they've obviously had things in the States like this, but it really feels like across the board, people are really starting to realize that, like, you've got to do it because it makes such a difference. And my only fear, not to necessarily speak about what side people are on or not, but, like, my only fear is that certain people are going to get into it and get driven by this election, and it's probably not going to go the way that not to assume things, but a lot of us want to go. But it's about trying to keep those people active and not just be like, oh, we lost, that was the point of this, we got all excited,
this is it.
But it's about like, no, but even if there's a slight difference, you know, there's people will start to change by thinking, hang on, the youth vote actually, we could see it. You know, they'll know all the numbers if they're like, wait, the youth vote is starting to become, I think.
Well, this is something that I think that needs to be continued after the election, because I think that if it doesn't go the way that a lot of people want it to go, then you're going to get some people that are going to come out and be like, well, fuck that then. Why? What was the point of me doing that? But I went to this thing that Julie did, Julie Adenuga did.
Yeah, it was great.
And there was one thing that one guy, because one of the things that came up was about people being disheartened. And I said, like, I have been voting. My mum has been encouraging me to vote since Wede, yeah. And a lot of the time, I didn't understand what I was voting for. I was just doing it because I was encouraged to do it. And then as time has gone on, like, most recently, I've started to read things more and I've started to understand things more. But I did feel like, rah, okay, obviously I'm going to vote this time, but yeah, there can be this level of disheartening if it doesn't go that way. But one of the things that a guy said on the panel was that you have to understand that it takes time. And if more and more people do it, at some point there will become a change. He said one of the things that struck with me was that he was like, well, look at like equal rights in terms of black people. This wasn't a thing that just happened within a year or a month or whatever. It was a situation where people had to persevere and you had to keep prodding along a little bit and you had to keep like fighting the battle until, you know, the message fully cut through.
Who was that guy? He was great, by the way.
I don't even know.
I'm assuming he was a model because he was very handsome.
Yeah. I don't know. I think some of his choice of words was a bit wrong in the sense of when he was saying, oh, if people don't vote, then it's a cop-out. Because I think that sometimes when people don't vote, it's just because they just don't understand. It's not necessarily about it being a cop-out. Sometimes some people don't understand. Some people don't really get it. And I wouldn't use that terminology. But yeah, anyway, that's a whole
thing. But it was really important, I do think
it is important as well to keep the conversation going afterwards. Because
yeah, for sure. And I think it's really important what Julie did there, because sometimes there's a bit of a stigma where people don't want to say, like, you know what, I don't know what any of this stuff is. Yeah. And people are a bit embarrassed because it's like, well, you should know.
I thought it was sick that she was saying things like, I don't know what this means. Yeah, I don't know what that means. Like, what does this mean? What does spoil a ballot mean? Like, it's good to have those conversations because people don't know. A lot of people don't know. So, but yeah. Anyway. Done though. We already just gave a man a round of applause in that, and then we carried on the conversation.
Encore.
No, encore.
That's what it is.
No, man. Okay, cool.
We've had Alex.
I like the show. I listened to it.
Respect, man. No, I like, really appreciate people. You coming on.
Yeah.
Put us on Noisy. We might blow.
Done though.
Yeah.
There you go. Thanks for coming through though, man. It's been great, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another guest.
Who you got?
Do you want to say? Because then obviously it might, like, what if it doesn't
imagine
happen?
Imagine we started throwing forward to the next show. If we were that organized,
is it certified?
All the time,
is it certified?
The next one is, but it's not always.
All right, we can do it this time.
All right, so the next show, 2 weeks' time, come back. We're going to be sitting down with Richard Thomas, who is Kano's manager and just a general all-round
favourites in this game. But
he's a character.
To be fair,
listen, yeah. Rich is wicked, and you know what? He's done a six-hour special
because he's got some.
He's done a hell of a lot in this game. Most notably, managing Kano for
over a decade from the start of his career, but he's done a lot. He's influenced a lot and kicked down a lot of doors, I think, for to get to where we are today. Honestly, he would take us back.
Well, so. I better take back what I said about him being my favourite manager, because obviously that's you. But, but I honestly think, you know, you know your stuff, but people could learn so much.
Trust me.
There's that balance of like he lives it. Like he is. You
trust
know, he's so passionate about his artist.
Yeah. Like, yeah, trust me.
That's good. I know you. Like Ben knows him. I've seen him a bunch of times, but never.
We did like half the interview on the phone because we were just talking about the potential of doing it, and we just went in for like 45 minutes.
Yeah, like you could not possibly find someone that you could be, you know, more happy for.
Yeah,
to this place now because he's literally this has been brewing since the beginning.
Trust me.
Yeah. So it's just like he's put in all this work, and suddenly it's like bricks and sold out.
It's mad.
Head festivals. Wow. You know,
sick. Like, crazy.
He's in such a good place. I'm really happy.
Well, yeah.
That's the next show. So you heard it here. Tune in 2 weeks time.
Yeah, man. Radar Radio. Welcome to the neighborhood. Go on about your business now. 570. Yeah. So what? You think you're the best? You against me, that's a disrespect. Sending you the top boy, still I ain't heard a better mixtape than Blacklisted yet. No playlist, no label home. Just a couple real niggas in an iPhone. Now everybody wanna talk.